Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast for 6, 7 and 8 figure Amazon and e-commerce sellers, a part of the amazing FBA family. If you want to scale fast, target a 7 figure exit and enjoy the process, then keep listening. Today's episode is sponsored by the new e-commerce podcast, The E-commerce Leader, co-hosted by myself, Michael Veazey, and Jason Miles, top 1% Shopify store owner and Udemy's highest rated e-commerce instructor. If you're the owner of a thriving e-commerce business, look for The E-commerce Leader on your favorite podcast app and subscribe today. Ladles and jealous spoons, boys and girls, welcome back to Amazing FBA. This is Michael Veazey, the host. I'm talking to Dylan Carter, who is Mr. Process, or Process, if you're on the other side of the pond. We've just had a massive geek out about business processes. We're going to try and bring it home to something a bit more actionable, specifically for those in the wholesale space. So if you're buying at wholesale prices and retailing on Amazon, broadly speaking. So Dylan, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on.
You obviously missed a process. So you built a tool to deal with managing supplier relationships for wholesale, but we better backtrack a couple of points. We've already talked about what wholesale is. What's your particular version in brief of the wholesale model, and why do you need to manage your relationships in such a structured way?
Really, if we clarify it, it's B2B sales, right? So if we can get away from the Amazon terminology for a bit, let's just focus on truly what it is, and that's B2B sales. And so if we know that and can believe in that, then we know it's going to be a numbers game, right? So I know I'm going to have a funnel. I know that I'm going to have a conversion rate between the suppliers I call versus the suppliers I get approved for versus the suppliers that are profitable, right? And then versus the ones that actually I place a test order with. And so there's a lot of things happening here. I need to be able to manage thousands of relationships easily. That's not the hardest part. The hardest part is actually just getting approved for the account, which we talked about a little bit on the previous episode, but it's very easy to lose track of where everybody's at. So previously, I tried to do this in Gmail. I was just like, I'll figure it out. It's fine. Until one day where I was going through my archives and was cleaning everything out, trying to attempt at getting at inbox zero, which yes, I definitely now have a process for. So I hit it every day. But either way, I find an email. I'm like, oh man, I totally forgot about that brand. I thought they just ghosted me basically. So I opened it up. No, they actually approved me. I just did not see the email because I had so much going on. I clicked through, I scanned the price sheets, and it was $2,000 a month in net profit. Now this is 3 months after I technically was approved. So that's $6,000, right? Yeah, $6,000. I had to think about that for a second. I need more coffee. $6,000 that I missed out on, a profit. Because I didn't have any methods for managing where everybody was, right? Like I needed to know, hey, they approved me. I need to now go scan their price sheet to see if it's profitable. Then I need to place a test order, right? So I have this funnel. I have this linear kind of stages that every brand I work with has to go through. Because what's great is I don't drop the ball anymore, right? I know which brands I need to follow up with. I know which brands that I've called, but they haven't picked up and I need to call again. I know which brands said that they approved me, but haven't sent me the application yet. I need to follow up there. And so having a relationship management kind of process, if you will, enables you to really extract more profitability. That's the interesting part here, right? Otherwise, you have no idea where anything's at. And what you don't want to do, which is what we almost certainly always do in the early stages, is keep that in your mind. Be like, oh yeah, I'll remember to do that. No, you won't. 9 times out of 10, you will not remember, and you will find $2,000 in net profit the day before. So it's important to manage those relationships. Now, listen, what we just talked about is just getting to the approval and placing a test order. That's, I said this again, that's the easy part. You have the second phase that nobody talks about, which is the ongoing management of that relationship, right? Because what's interesting, we kind of mentioned a 80-20 principle. So the Pareto principle on the last episode, I'll bring it up again here. I did an analysis in Inventory Lab and said, okay, show me all of the brands that generate X revenue for the past 3 months. I did 3 months. And said, okay, what's the 20%? What are the 20% of my suppliers that generate 80% of my revenue? There was two. So what happens when I lose one? Theoretically, 40%, assuming they're break even, 40% of my revenue goes down because of one decision. So do you think it's important for me to take those two suppliers and really expand our relationship together? You're getting phone calls. How you guys doing? I'm going to send you some wine. Hey, you're going to this conference. Let me buy you dinner, right? And a lot of people don't think about that. They go, no, I have the account. I don't need to do that anymore. No, it needs to be ongoing because at any moment they could say, hey, we don't want to work with you anymore. We have somebody else who's willing to do X, Y, and Z, and you just really haven't stepped up.
Yeah, that's the other thing that people don't think about with relationships of general. So you talked about CRM. I'm glad you said it's contact relationship management, because customer relationship management is not something we get to do a lot on Amazon, but I think it's really important, even if it's literally just sending somebody, just getting somebody on the phone in some way, or just meeting with some person, even if they haven't bought your product via Amazon. But the same with everything else, which is to say, everyone sweats really hard to look at their Amazon listings to see what's wrong with the products that their competition is selling when they're about to start selling. But then they don't go and do it again. They don't get feedback. And actually, that means that you're leaving the path wide open for somebody else to come along and do the same thing to you. And the same with the suppliers, right? You said in your last episode that you're prepared to go through, you know, hundreds of dollars worth of work, effectively optimizing listings, running PPC, doing photography in order to win the business. But that means somebody else can do the same thing. So unless you're staying ahead of the curve in some form, and it kind of doesn't matter what the competition is doing exactly, whether it's in this case with wholesale offering, you know, some effectively free management, or whether it's for the consumer offering more features. It's the same basic principle, which is you need to get ahead of the curve to offer something, to offer a bit of a moat around your business. And then you need to keep that moat topped up, to extend the metaphor. And you've just put your finger on that, which I think is in both business models a very neglected area, is that the innovation and protection of what you have.
And it increases your profitability. Here's the funny part that we didn't mention in the last episode, related to, you know, I'm potentially willing to, you know, invest $500, whatever it may be, into that relationship because it's got a positive ROI. But what you're not factoring in, and what we didn't even mention, is the fact that by you doing those things, listing optimization, PPC, you're increasing your profitability. So what do your brands want? More sales. What do you want? More sales. So how do you marry that from an operational standpoint? Right? Because when they're winning, you're winning. When you're winning, they're winning. You're locked hand in hand together in this relationship. So a lot of people see things like, you know, investing into that relationship as just a sunk cost. And I'm telling you, it's not, right? Especially if we're doing PPC, right? Like, who wins when you do PPC on your inventory? Well, you do. You get more sales. Who wins when you do listing optimization? Yes, theoretically, everybody. I get it. But you're still increasing your sales. And so if you can view it from that light, it makes a lot more sense to say, okay, you know, yes, mathematically it makes sense either way because there's a positive ROI, but take it a step further. Why aren't you not doing this to begin with, right? Like it's the amount of people who let's say do 500 units per month on one SKU. They've never optimized anything. They've never tested PPC. I'm like, why are you leaving so much money on the table? Because I mean, one, your brand's going to look at you and be like, wait, how are you selling 30% more units than our other Amazon buyers? Oh, well, here's what I do. Oh, you do that for free? Yeah, why wouldn't I? Like, I make more money. So the fact that other Amazon sellers are not doing it seems very irrational from the brand's mind. So now guess what you have? Negotiating power. You have leverage. So now you get to say, listen, you want to do more business with me? Perfect. Here's what I need. I would love to have an exclusive agreement on the account. Obviously, the other Amazon sellers are unwilling or unable to do what I'm doing. I have the cash flow to absorb their sales as well. So think about this. Instead of me just running PPC on the 500 units that I'm able to run, I can now run PPC on the 3,000 units I'm able to move for you per month.
So I was going to ask a probably dumb private labeler type question here. So I'm very used to running PPC on a private label product where obviously you're the only seller. But would you suggest running PPC on a listing where you're sharing, say, the buy box with, say, four other sellers?
Yeah, PPC. You do. So here's the myth. Everybody thinks running PPC when there's other sellers on a listing means that they also get a share in that. They don't. Your PPC ads only show your inventory. And if you're not buy box eligible, they're not running, right? So here's what's interesting. A lot of people are freaked out when it comes to PPC because they're like, no, I'm wasting money. I'm giving sales to my competition. You are literally not. Amazon is a very smart company. And the platform is designed so that every dollar you spend goes back to your inventory. So here's what's interesting from a private label standpoint, and I'm not a PL person by any means, relatively expensive, right? Because you're going for competitive keywords. Wholesale, normally, it's so cheap. It is so cheap. You can have basic, terrible campaigns that are very profitable because most of the time I'm running campaigns with keywords with like the brand name in it because nobody's running that because it's not a private label type product, right? So nobody's running those. So I'll give you a prime example. I had a product, the net profit was $55 per unit. It was only moving like 30 units per month, still pretty good, but I knew I could boost it, right? If I got $55 in net profit per unit, I got space to spend. So I was like, even if it cost me so much, it's still profitable. Even it started to cost me $5 per unit for each additional sale that came through. So I traded $5 for $50 with wholesale.
Good trade.
It's so good, right? I mean, it only scales so far, but still I'm able to go back to the brand and be like, listen, is anybody else running PPC? They're like, no. I'm like, what? Like, what do you mean they're not running PPC? You have $55 in net profit. There's no reason you shouldn't be. And I'm not even good with PPC. So again, leverage, right?
It does sound like relative to the sophistication that people have to have in the private label type businesses with regard to advertising, it sounds like that the barrier is pretty low.
Oh God, yeah.
In wholesale. Well, like if most people aren't even advertising, the barrier is ultra low, like nothing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That does sound like an incredible opportunity. I'm just about to go back to a client who, to be fair, has got the smallest account. I'm running the smallest account in the world. There's probably a record. Hopefully he's not listening, but we sold 7 units last week. I mean, that's quite sad. And I've got to go back to him and say, okay, so you put a bottom on your pricing, which is still, in my mind, very overpriced. And also, we need to be willing to spend on PPC. There's so much resistance every time.
I don't know why.
Well, I mean, maybe his profit margins aren't great, but I look at his margins, I'm like, they're actually pretty healthy.
But it scales. Your margin, as long as it's profitable.
It scales, that's the thing. Like, I don't really care if it's a 20% return. You know what it is? It's an overvaluing of profit margin per unit economics over cash flow. If you tied up months and months, maybe even years in a really bad case like this one, worth of money in your stock and it's not moving, then you're out of whack. You're valuing unit economics way more than cash flow. And in the end, the cash flow is going to kill your business.
We're going to sit on this for a second because this was a huge realization. So obviously, I'm one of the co-founders of Aura, which is a repricing tool. And so we deal a lot with pricing competition.
Of course you do,
Although you have a lot of people have preconceived notions that, listen, hey, my price or the tool lowered my price by 20 cents. I'm losing money. Your ROI at the current price minus the 20 cents is still like 80% ROI. You're not losing money, one. You're losing opportunity, which is different. Two, yes, the price lowered by 20 cents, but we increased the volume of your sales by 30%. So mathematically, in total, you are making more money. So I think a lot of sellers, because a lot of people come at this from like RAOA, which is like, oh, 300% ROI, right? It's always about that. Listen, when you transfer over from not having 5 units per SKU to having dozens, if not hundreds or thousands per SKU, unit economics do not matter. Total economics matter. And what I mean by that is, yes, we can lower your price. Your margin is lower technically. But if we can increase your sales, because guess what? It's economics, supply and demand. If we lower your price and increase the volume of your sales, you will make more money in total per month. And so many sellers miss that by a large margin.
Yeah.
And if you can make that one change in your business, that alone, no new capital, nothing like that, that one change will completely change the profitability of your business. And I think I wanted to highlight that because it's incredibly important.
No, thank you. That's really, really helpful. And for somebody who specializes in, you know, the processes of pricing, that's really worthwhile feedback because you know whereof you speak. And I was, when you're talking about margin, what sprang to my mind just then when you were talking is Jeff Bezos' famous and rather scary phrase, which is your margin is my opportunity. If you've got fat margins hanging out there, there's a reason why it's not going to be sustainable. There are certain figures that turn up in industries again and again. So certain profit margins. I mean, an e-commerce business that's well run will probably have a net profit margin before taxes of between the 10 and 20%. It ain't going to be 30. And if it's only 5, it's probably a little bit, you know, on life support. But it's quite a narrow range. And I think there are reasons that push towards that. And, you know, profit margins and gross profit margins tend in certain ranges, you know, 30 to 40% is a typical range for private label. I mean, I'm not saying you can't get bigger, but, you know, it depends on multiple factors. But it's interesting how narrow the range is. And I think that's because there's only a certain degree of sustainability for a business that has really high unit economic, you know, profit margin and really low stock turnover, because it's going to go out of business sooner or later, and then they'll be removed from the market. So there are certain averages, aren't there, that seem to turn up.
Yeah.
That the market pushes you in a certain direction somehow. And particularly Amazon is, I just worth bearing in mind that reality check that Amazon is a price comparison site by design. I mean, Jeff Bezos has made an open secret, the three things that customers always want. And he's consistent about this and consistently acting on it, I would say, is three things: greater selection, lower prices, and faster delivery. And apart from faster delivery, the lower prices and greater selection don't do any of us as individual sellers any favors. We've got to recognize that, right? It is a price comparison environment. But here's the
thing. He's not saying lower margins. This is important. I want to highlight this.
True.
Here's where the innovation comes in. And I've yet to see this in the private label space. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay.
Most people go, oh, private label's dead because margins are lower. No. Private label in your mind might feel dead, quote unquote, even though I don't think it is, for margins, because you have not attempted to innovate on your costs. Guys, this is how this works. Across the board, prices over time for everything will decrease. Now, outside of like luxury items, that's different. You're paying for a brand that's completely different. You're probably not building a Ferrari or an, you know, Amiga right now, right? You're not building that brand. That's okay. So if you know that that's where the platform is going, and by the way, we all have what's called platform risk. If Amazon shuts down and all you do is sell on Amazon, you're screwed, right? Amazon can make one decision, your business is done. Keep that in mind. So your alignment with what the platform wants needs to be good. Because what you can do is you can see an opportunity and say, okay, well, I sell the garlic press, right? Like the traditional example for PL. I sell a garlic press. Okay. Margins are down to 5%. It's about to go out. All the competition are not replenishing. What do you do? Well, from an economic standpoint, you could say, I'm going to wait for them all the brands to fold. I'm going to hold and bring the price back up because there's less supply. That's an option. Or two, you can find ways to innovate on your cost. Can you lower your cost so that you have the same margin? Margins shift up and down, right? It's relative to your cost and your revenue. Okay, if revenue is going down, but you want to maintain the same cost, lower your costs. What does Walmart do? That's how they made it work. People are like, I don't know how they're making money. Their margins are the same. Their costs are lower. How do they do that? Well, one of the things they do is they buy a ridiculous amount of volume to have negotiating power. They have buyer power. Okay, can we do that? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe you can realize I can order 100,000 units once a year, have it stored. It's going to cost me some money, but I can figure that out mathematically. And because I'm ordering such high volume, my costs are dramatically lower. Maybe that's an opportunity. I don't know. But that's where you as the entrepreneur get to innovate, right? It's very easy to be like, oh, well, the dynamics don't work anymore. Based on what? Right? Like, is that so the entire market is shot? No, like you're your own business. You get to make your own decisions here. So you get to reverse engineer and be creative and think of ways to solve a really interesting problem that other sellers are not willing or able to do.
Yeah. And here's one classic example, and it's very real. Capital limitations is one of the answers that would be to your question of one thing is buying powder. Oh, but I've only got $10,000 in the bank. But okay, here's what I would say. There are people out there with money, and I meet them. Sometimes I'm good at getting some of it, but most of the time I'm good at, you know, completely messing it up, the relationship, and running in the opposite direction, whatever. But every so often, you're going to come across somebody with more money than skill. In fact, there's a lot of it in the world, even now. I mean, Warren Buffett has just sold some airlines, but he's still got a pile of money personally. And you know, his fund has just crazy amounts of money. There's money in the world. And money's if you cheap. Can get the skill of putting together the deal where if you can get $50,000 or $100,000, whatever, for a particular product line to source it for a year, you can get incredible unit, you know, you've got your margin back. And yeah, the cash flow is slower, but you got a big enough fund that it works. And then you come into deals with the supplier. Normally you do something like order a year's worth of inventory and then pay them in 3 month tranches. That's not an uncommon deal with very expensive products. And that's becoming increasingly suggested with the suppliers right now in the COVID-19 situation at the time of recording, mid-May or early May 2020. And suddenly, you know, actually, you know, the money isn't actually the problem. The problem is persuading the person with the money to give it to you because you know what you're doing. which I think, again, it comes back to your favorite skill and probably mine, business-to-business sales, right?
Right.
It's actually a convincing problem. It's not a capital problem. I mean, yes, it is, but it's your personal capital problem can be solved by somebody else's capital. And I think people people underuse that one. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't come with strings attached. I'm not saying, you know, it's easy. It's not easy. But none of this stuff's easy. But then once you've identified the problem as a sales problem, for example, not a capital problem, I think then you have to find a different skill set or find a person with a different skill set and let them take a percentage and go and get the money from you, whatever it is. I'm not claiming this is to be a piece of cake because it really isn't. But I know enough people who've managed to raise money from things to scale their businesses to do exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about, that I know it is real, at least. Let's put it that way.
I'll tell you right now, I have a buddy, he runs Amazon lending business. His biggest problem right now is finding people to invest in.
Really?
That are worth it. I mean, think about it, right? Because a lot of people are like, oh, I'm going to go raise 50 grand. It's like, but you have no reason to do so. Like your business actually can't utilize it. So if you're a good fit, listen, if you have a good business and you need to raise money and you can provide reasons as to like, okay, here's where it's going. Here's why I need it. Here's the unit economics. Here's the math. Raising money is not difficult. One, it's cheap. Interest rates are ridiculously low. I'm at a point where I'm like, man, I want to start more businesses, but I don't really have the time. So there's people like me, certainly much larger than I am, who say, hey, I've got money, but not a lot of time, but I still want to do more stuff. Cool. Well, hey, you go do it. I'll give you the money. I'll be the financier. Maybe it's equity. Maybe I buy 20% of your company. Maybe it's straight debt. Maybe it's royalty. Here's something you could do. Hey, I'm going to buy 100,000 units. I need $100,000. That's super cheap, but roll with me here. I'll give you $1 in net profit or 50 cents in net profit, whatever it makes out for each of those units as they sell through. So now you're not coming out of pocket because it's kind of performance-based, right? Or you mentioned the tranching, right? Like there's no reason why you can't say, hey, fact, I want 100,000 units. It's a year's worth. I'm going to commit to you to doing that, but I don't want them to ship. I want to ship X number per month. So one, you don't have to manufacture them upfront. You don't have a cash flow problem. I don't have to pay you upfront, but I'm still committing contractually to purchasing that amount. What's the downside? Factory doesn't have a cash flow problem. You don't have a cash flow problem, but you still get to negotiate annual, you know, that amount of volume basically, right? I mean, there's so many unique negotiating points kind of within that, like everything from A to Z, like you said, but it's the easiest thing. Like, you know, and that's where innovation comes in, right? It's thinking high level, right? It's saying, okay, I have a problem, but really it's an opportunity. And I can tell you for, you know, a lot of my experience, a lot of Amazon sellers don't think this way. It's very much, you know, simple, clear cut.
I mean, I love your, maybe you're just used to these kind of high level conversations and I'm frankly not, and I love your optimism, your can do thing, which is a very American kind of virtue, but I maybe it's just harder to raise money in the UK. Maybe just the people I've worked with find it hard. I don't know. But the point being that, you know, a lot of UK-based sellers sell in America. I mean, yes, maybe you got to form an LLC. You got to fly out there and have a holiday in Florida and form an LLC somewhere in Delaware, whatever. This is not such a terrible thing. I mean, people fly to China all the time to go and see their suppliers. And most people, frankly, say, I go in there, I see my supplier and I get out. I mean, it's not really a holiday destination of choice for most people, whereas something like Vietnam, India, maybe. But the point being that it's not beyond the wit of man to fly out to, you know, America and form an LLC. I mean, yeah, I'm sure it's a pain, but
if you can
borrow 500,000 or get an SBA loan or whatever it is, there could be so many upsides. The point is, it's no harder than trying to source quality stuff from China, which is the hardest thing in the world. I mean, private labor is not easy, you know. So if you can do that, I really think, and I'm saying this stuff like I haven't done it, right? So what right do I have to say this? It's obviously true. I know some people who are doing it, and you're yet another person who's saying, like, I've got a friend who has money and they haven't found enough investable businesses. I know enough that it's out there, and I guess that I haven't got the right to say I've done it, and therefore all I can do is put it out there as a thought-provoking thing. I guess if I'd done it already, then people might actually do what I'm saying and make more money. One of the frustrations I have. Yeah, that's interesting. Go on.
So I disagree, only because I love people make their own excuses based off of somebody else, right?
Yeah,
I had somebody at one point was like, when I was doing live sourcing, they're like, what car do you drive? I'm like, why are you asking? Because I know why you're asking. You're asking because if I don't say Lambo, you think I'm a failure.
Right.
Right? what happens when I literally hate cars and I have a Honda Civic? I'm like, I don't care about cars. I care about something else, right? Does that now negate everything I'm saying or my experience, my knowledge, like my points? It doesn't. Mm. And so it's less about me and you, right? Like,
yeah, well, exactly.
More like this is a seed, right? This is a seed of which is possible. I'm not saying that I've ever gone and raised $500,000 because I haven't needed to. But I'm telling you, if I needed to, I could.
I know people who have. And the reason they were able to do that is it's a bit one of those chicken and egg things. You know, you probably can't go from selling, you know, $10,000 a month to persuading somebody to lend you $500,000. It's got to ramp up in stages. But
sure.
I own people in the mastermind that I run with who came in doing about $200,000 a month. So $250,000, $300,000, whatever. And, you know, they've now got some pretty hefty loans but they're profitable and their cash flow is good and the business is thriving and growing. But they struggled for about a year and a half to get the loans, but they kept at it. And they went to banks in the end, which are the hardest people to get loans from. I'm not saying any of this stuff is easy, but it's possible. And the point is on the other side of the really difficult but possible is just lots of profit. These guys are really doing well.
Mm-hmm. And you might only need 10 grand. What if you need to raise 10,000 pounds?
Yeah.
There's people that will absolutely do that. Be like, hey, I've got 100,000 pounds to my name. I will give you 10,000 pounds if you can give me a positive return. You're only doing 10,000 per month in revenue. That's fine. Right. Yeah. Like, so it scales. I mean, if you need to raise 2,000 pounds, you can do that too. Right. So it's all relative.
It is. I mean, the funny thing is, you know, even though in theory you would have thought that I have the skills to do this myself, I know how much flipping work it is to create a private label product. Yep. If I knew somebody who was able to do that in a really reliable way and they wanted to borrow £1,000 off me before Christmas, just around, say, August, September, to put in the Q4 order for a particular product line that had a proven profitability and they were going to pay me a decent percentage that I thought was commensurate with the risk, and I'd probably be better able to judge the risk than somebody who doesn't do the Amazon thing all day, then I'd be pretty comfortable at lending them £1,000 or dollars as a affordable percentage of my net worth.
Yeah.
For somebody else, that might be 10. But if you got 15 people to do that, you suddenly might be playing with another $20,000-$30,000, which really would enable you to be massively stocked. And again, then all the unit economic virtues and profit margins, what have you, could kick in. That's not a hard sell. I mean, and I'm cynical because I've been around this game enough, but even I know a good product when I see it. And I, you know what? I could invest $1,000 in my own product that isn't proven yet, or I could invest $1,000 in a wholesale brand, but I've got to go through the pain of creating that relationship. Or I can say, this guy, I know him, I know his business, I know this market, I've done a bit of research, the chances are pretty good. So I'm going to say, if you give me 15% or something pretty healthy, or maybe it's 10 or whatever, but that accounts for the risk, then I'll do it. And even little old me could be pitched on that. And I'm quite cynical. And, you know, I've seen the Amazon game enough to know that 1,000 invested in some inventory is going to come back with a good, healthy interest and a good, solid chance of return, you know, within a couple of months. That sounds like a good deal. I'll take it.
Think about your other Amazon sellers that you know in your network, right? So you mentioned somebody's doing 200K a month. That's awesome. Maybe they're kind of capping out. Maybe they're like, hey, I've got cash to invest. I can either go launch a new SKU, but let's say they've already done that. Let's say they've got, they have 12 SKUs and they're like, the brand's just solid. It's cash cow right now. Well, what do they know? They know Amazon. So could you go to them as a friend, as an acquaintance and say, listen, I'm doing 10, 20, 30, 50 K per month. I'm trying to get to where you are. I need to raise money. Well, if they have no place to place that cash, they're already looking for investments anyway.
Yeah.
So it's easier to be like, so I can give you 50 grand. You're already proven. You're just growing. And I know how to grow. And what's great is because I know this stuff, I can help you. So not only can I give you the 50 grand, I will teach you everything I know, because that I'm going to get my money back faster. Or maybe, hey, give me 50 grand, I'll give you 20 in the company. Now they really want to increase the value of your company because that 20% equity can go up dramatically. Yeah. These are all things that happen in normal life outside of Amazon, but they certainly do happen, I would say, more so in closed doors in the Amazon world, but it's very feasible and it's very quote unquote normal in the business world.
What you're talking about is, again, that thing you mentioned in the first episode we had in this interview, taking a business model from elsewhere and applying it to where it isn't usually applied. And thus, suddenly it looks very creative and different. And what's going to happen in the Amazon space is you'll do it once, you'll get a little success and make $5,000, and then you'll write an entire course and training modules around it. And I say that as somebody who did something similar. I started a podcast after selling pretty mediocre products on Amazon for a year. I'm no different, except that for me, there's a sort of intellectual curiosity that has to be there. And I've got to find it exciting and interesting. And if you're just doing the same old, the person you're pitching to will have heard the same pitch. At least it's refreshingly different. And if it sounds outrageous, you might just get somebody who goes for it because they're bored.
That's the point, though.
I don't mean just bored. I mean bored in a business-like sense that their money is in boring places, which are kind of working, but not really getting them where they want to go, the speed they want to go. And something that might have a chance of failing might also have a chance of succeeding on a bigger scale than they would normally have. And it comes down to risk-reward ratios and how much capital they can afford to lose. But, I mean, if you've got a really unusual proposition, but that makes sense, you might just get the deal. I mean, I'm saying this, it's easy to say this stuff, and I'm conscious of that.
Well, it's simple, not easy, right? Like, it's straightforward. I'll give you 2 to 3 right now. So I love your point of, like, you know, somebody gets some success and then they launch a course. I vowed to never launch a course. I consider doing like a wholesale course, but it would be completely free and better than anything you saw. I may still do that, but completely free. Like, here's the way I view business. Yes, there's the value kind of stage. And this is knowledge, right? These are things you should be giving away for free because you're not really solving problems, right? You're organizing data. Don't get me wrong. I pay for courses. I do like courses. Not saying anything bad about them. But there's more value to be had when you're viewing things based off the conversation we're having, right? So here's a great example. I know right now there are 2 opportunities that I think are very interesting. Actually, I'm going to give you 3 because I mentioned 3. And they're roughly similar but slightly different approaches. 1, there's a huge opportunity in my mind, especially right now, to purchase a physical products brand that is primarily brick and mortar. Taking your Amazon knowledge and then launching that brand on Amazon to increase the valuation, revenue, and sales of that business and then exiting it or just holding it. Likewise, the inverse. Take a 6-figure worth private label brand. Let's say it's a really good product, a really great brand, and then taking it brick and mortar. Because by the way, brick and mortar still completely overshadows online sales. That may change after this whole COVID thing, but as of now, it's still more, right? Okay, so we can do the inverse of those 2 things. Do you think it's hard for me to go raise money to say, listen, I have expertise, knowledge on Amazon. I understand physical products businesses. What I want to do is acquire this business for $3 million. And then I want to take it, I'm going to grow it through online multi-channel, increase it to $5 million and exit it. Now, if I can do that once with a proof of concept, I will have 0 problems because now I have a track record at raising money. If I want to go raise $10 million, I can do it. Here's another one. This is the 3rd. So I'm a finance major. So a lot of my financial academics were focusing on valuations, investing, and stuff like that. Okay, well, there's a lot to be said about acquiring private label brands as a private equity firm. So private equity just means you're going to bring in private money that you raised. You're going to literally own the company, hold it. So you're going to use what's called an LBO, a leverage buyout. Leverage buyout just means you're going to use debt. So I'm going to buy your private label brand for $1 million. I'm going to do 60% leverage. So I'm going to take 40% of the cash on that deal from my coffers, so to speak. I'm going to go to a bank and say, give me 60%. So give me $600,000 as leverage. It's debt. I'm going to pay off that debt. But here's what's interesting. Let's say that's a 5-year loan, which is pretty average, 5, 7, maybe even 10 years. Let's say we do a 5-year loan. So I bought a business for $1 million. Now I only put in 400 grand, right? After 5 years, I paid off the 600. So I started with 400 grand cash in that business. I then sell it. Let's say the company didn't grow. It's still only worth $1 million. The debt's paid off from the profits of the business. So now when I go to sell that business, I'm not just getting my $400,000. I'm getting $1 million in cash. So what happens when you do that times 10? What happens when you build a private equity firm where you go raise $1 million and you do this with 6-figure valued private label brands and you build a really awesome team where all you do is you focus on taking mid 6-figure private label brands and growing them to 7 figures and then selling them? That's an opportunity. And I'm telling you, it's way better and more scalable than a course. It's way better than having 100 people pay you $2,000. Like, I get it. It's a lot of cash flow up front, but it certainly doesn't help you a year from now. Build that kind of business. Because if you want to raise money, that's how you do it. That's the ideas you need to be coming up with because they're unique.
I spoke to, well, quite a few business brokers recently. I spoke to a guy called Walker Dybel of Quiet Like Brokerage, but he's written a book called Buy Then Build, I think it's called. It's a similar idea. What the interesting thing you're mentioning about brick and mortar businesses, coming back to banks and bank loans, even though, again, look, we're in the middle of a COVID-19 thing. What happens next? Everyone's speculating. Who knows? But I think there will be a cultural shift. But until this point, say January, March 2020, banks traditionally would lend on things based on collateral and cash flow. And the collateral of a physical building is reassuring to have, right? Now, okay, maybe less so than it was, but still, if you want to get a bank loan to do that, you're probably much more likely to get something based on some physical assets. I think he bought something with a printing press or something obscure, just partly because he could get a bank loan because there was some physical collateral, which is harder to put up a website as collateral that a bank will take seriously these days, right? And that may shift. That'll be interesting to see. But that makes a lot of sense. So there's even more, I think, of an argument in favor of purchasing a physical products brand because, okay, it's going to be super cheap right now relative to where it would ever have been in the last 20, 50 years. And then also you probably can collateralize that to a degree. That's such a big picture opportunity. I don't think we can top that. I think we're going to have to just bring this one back down to earth.
I love it. I love it.
Just a couple of simple things. I mean, you've got Vendrive that you offer the CRM relationships for wholesale. So the customer relationship management thing. And we've got, so I'm just going to give the URL for that, vendrive.com, which is worth checking out. And I'm certainly going to be subscribing. Just feel like right now I'm trying to develop relationships with brands that I want to do some management for them, and other people that I'm trying to bring into masterminds, which is a slightly different business model, but it's very established. And one of the mental blocks for meeting it is, I know from trying to do it in the past that it was a mess, and having a system that is ready made and structured is just going to take a weight off my mind. So
yeah,
I'm certainly going to be a customer.
Awesome.
Listen, it's been really fun to talk about, and we covered a hell of a lot of topics, some of which yeah, unexpected. Right? And I think in the end, what's really healthy about this is creative business thinking, which is kind of really utterly out of fashion in this Amazon space somehow. It's become cloyingly same old, same old. And yeah. I just think it's not healthy business-wise, and it's not a good way to create a defensible business. So this is really fun stuff. I think it's the driver at a strategic level of a defensible, enjoyable business. It's got to be a good thing. So
love it.
Listen, it's been great. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for having me on, man.
Thanks so much for listening to the 10K Collective podcast, part of the family of amazing FBA podcasts. Today's episode is sponsored by the new e-commerce podcast, The E-Commerce Leader. The podcast is hosted by yours truly and Jason Miles, multi-million dollar Shopify owner and Udemy's highest rated e-commerce instructor. If you're the owner of a thriving online business and you want to become the best e-commerce leader you can be, it's got your name on it. For free guides and mini courses on many topics, go to www.theecommerceleader.com.